Just so I know, your name is pronounced Agastya, is that correct? Or
Yeah.
Agastya. Okay. Very nice to meet you.
Same here. Actually, I was supposed to schedule the interview for 5 p.m., not 6. I made a calculation error.
Oh.
Daylight saving time zone, and because of that, okay, here we are. So thank you for agreeing to discuss your findings. I'd like to ask you about your discovery, its findings, and the inferences of, and anything that we can do for the future investigation.
That's a lot you just said out there.
What
So,
prompted your
yeah, anything first that you would like me to talk about?
interest in archaeology?
Okay. I guess that goes back all the way to my childhood, right? Like it's sort of a lifelong thing for me. My father was very interested in history. So I think that sort of inspired me to study ancient humans, I guess. But specifically archaeology, like I really had no idea what archaeology is. And I think the general public also doesn't really have an idea of what archaeology is. And so it wasn't until I got into school, started studying it, did I figure out what archaeology was. You know, it's so much more than history or studying artifacts to interpret history, right? History is more so about like what is written down, what these prominent people in society wrote down, right? And archaeology is about figuring out what normal everyday people did. So I think it's really cool what we can learn doing archaeology.
What was the initial purpose of this study?
So the initial purpose really was just to find out what animals the bone. So I was studying bone tools for my dissertation. And there's all sorts of different things one can learn studying bone tools. But to specifically figure out what animals these bones came from would be a little more difficult studying bone tools because bone tools are transformed either through manufacturing or through use or both, depending which bone tools they are. But these were small little fragments, really, really hard to identify based on morphological characteristics alone. So we wanted to apply this method Zooms to look at the to study the collagen in the bone to then assess what animals these bones came from.
Could you briefly explain the study and its findings?
I don't know how brief I can be, but I'll try to be brief. But yeah, like I mentioned in the previous question, I was studying these bone tools. They're specifically bone tools that Neanderthals made and used. And we just had five of these. They came from two different sites in the southwest of France. One artifact came from this one site called Pestalozzi I, and then four came from another site, Abbiparni. And then these bone tools were found actually across three different archaeological layers. So two different archaeological layers at Abbiparni. So these five bone tools are all pretty similar. They all looked very similar. They had a similar size, similar shape. They all came from some sort of animal rib. We can tell that by doing like a morphological analysis. But we wanted to use zooarchaeology by mass spectrometry to try to assess what animal species the bones came from. So then I mentioned the one from this other site, Pestalozzi 1. We didn't get any results from that one artifact. But then the four from Abri Perini, they all came back with positive results, all actually having the same ID, either coming from bison or aurochs, so some sort of large bovid. And then, I mean, there's so much more involved in the study too. Those are the main results. But then we compared the results from the Zooms analysis to the zooarchaeological analysis from all of the faunal remains at the site. And what was really cool was that in one of the archaeological layers where three of these bone tools came from, the layer was dominated by reindeer, having 90% reindeer remains in this site. So then just thinking about that, we did a whole statistical analysis too. But then just thinking about that 90% reindeer, and then three of these bone tools come from this large bovid. Really, really seems like Neanderthal specifically chose to use the large bovid ribs as their tool of choice. And then, like I said, we also did a statistical analysis that supported that as well, that Neanderthals were selecting these large bovid ribs.
How did you get involved in this study?
So that actually started back quite a while ago now for me. It was before I even got into graduate school. It was back when I was an undergraduate student. So I got my graduate degrees as well as my undergraduate degree at UC Davis. So that's where I've been for a while, University of California, Davis. And so as an undergrad, I took a zooarchaeological, a zooarchaeology course from Teresa Steele, who would then turn out to be my dissertation advisor. And so I was doing an internship with her. She was studying the fauna remains from this site, Abri Perini. And so she had me doing really, really tedious work, just counting and weighing teeny tiny little pieces of bone that were like 2 centimeters or less in size. And then when I was doing that work, I actually found one of these bone tools. And so then one thing led to the next. That I get to grad school, then I get to study these bone tools, and well, now here we are. But that was like, was it 10 years? I guess that was 9 years ago when I first started working with Dr. Teresa Steele.
How many institutes were involved in this research?
So on the paper, I think it lists 7 different institutes. But I mean, 2 of the institutions were the main institutions, I would say. So University of California, Davis, where I got my dissertation, where my advisor also is a professor. But then the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology is where the, for the most part, where the Zooms analysis was conducted. And then several researchers are also affiliated with the Max Planck Institute. And then there are some other institutions that some of the other researchers are affiliated with. But I would say the majority of work either happened at UC Davis or at the Max Planck Institute.
What activities did this study involve?
What activities? So the main activities I would say would be the Zooms analysis, the zooarchaeological analysis, so the study of the fauna, and then the statistical analyses. But in addition to those, I mean, there's so many different things that are involved in a study like this. So like things that happened even before we started doing the study. So, like, you know, just having to excavate the site and gather the artifacts and wash them and various things like that. But then also, you know, writing and brainstorming and emailing colleagues and data organization. Like, there's all sorts of different things that goes on.
What was the timeline of the study?
It's even hard for me to remember right now, actually. But I think when we first decided to do a study like this, it would have been like back in 2017. And then from there, I think some of the first results were obtained at the end of 2017. And then once, so when I say results, I mean the first Zooms results were obtained at the end of 2017. And that's when I started comparing the Zooms results to the rest of the fauna at the site, you know, which species of fauna are found at the site. Not all of the bone tools had Zooms results right away. So that, you know, trying to get more Zooms results took several tries, several more months. And then I think by the end of 2018, we had a solid draft about ready to submit for publication. But then, well, this is getting into a whole lot of other things. But anyway, we had to then collect more data. We decided to collect, to generate more Zooms data on just the fauna from the site to compare the results, like non-destructive results from the fauna to the morphological identification, see if those were corroborated. And so that was mostly done in 2019. And then at the end of 2019, we had pretty much our final draft ready, or near final draft ready of the paper to go before it was submitted for publication. So anyway, several years.
What were the roles of other people involved in the study?
The roles. So there were three of researchers on the study. I mean, the last three listed on the paper: Teresa Steele, Shannon McFerrin, Marie Sorcy. They're all my dissertation advisors. I already mentioned Teresa Steele as my main dissertation advisor, but the two other are also like external advisors for me. And they helped a lot in constructing the design of the research. So that was a big role that they played there. Frieda Welker, actually, I think it says right, like at the top of the paper, that he contributed equally to this research as I did. So Frieda is the, he's like the Zoom expert, the Zooms expert on this paper. So I'm not. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. I'm like the bone tool expert, and Frieda Welker is the Zooms expert. So he did the initial Zooms analyses, and then he also got one of his grad students involved, Virginie Sine Mahiot, and she did some subsequent Zooms analyses, and then they also had someone named Arndt Wilk. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but he also helped with some of the Zooms analyses. And then Tamara, and I always say her last name wrong, Daganzik, I think. She was one of the archaeologists at Abri-Pyrénées, so she helped with context, site context, where these bone tools came from in the site. And then Will Rondeau worked at the Pestalozzi 1 site, and so he helped with context there and the fauna there. And then, did I miss anyone? Oh, Mark Grote. He was a very important person on this paper. He was the statistician. And so I worked closely with him doing the statistical analysis. I think I got everyone.
Which activity took the most time and attention?
Which activity took the most time and attention? I mean, this might not be the answer you were looking for, but like probably just coordinating everyone's schedules and getting everyone on the same track. I mean, like actually when you go and do something, like one thing doesn't necessarily take all that long. But then, yeah, it builds up to taking a lot of time altogether.
What was the most difficult part of the study?
The most difficult part. Well, I think it would probably have to do with validating our results. So since we conducted a non-destructive study, then that brings in the big issue. How do we know that our results are actually what we say they are, since it's non-destructive? Were we even testing something that came from the bone? So really conducting a lot of separate analyses to make sure our samples weren't contaminated and making sure that our results were actually coming from the bones. I think that was probably the most difficult part.
How long did it take to conduct the research?
Well, like I said, we started back in 2017. So with all the various aspects put together, I mean, it was probably 2.5 years. But then, like I said in a previous question, like there's a lot of things that happened even before we decided to do this study. So I don't know. It depends exactly what you're asking.
What was your first reaction after confirming the hypothesis was true?
Well, I was extremely excited to get the results. I mean, I guess that was my reaction. I was just extremely excited to have any results, first of all, but then to get the results that we got, that all of the bones from Abry-Pyrénées were from the same type of animals, really was beyond exciting. And like I knew this would be an interesting study, interesting paper that I could write because of that. So it really motivated me, I guess.
Were you anticipating this outcome?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I would say before I got very involved in like before I started my dissertation work, I wasn't the one. So these bone tools were found before I was even involved in this study, or some of the bone tools, right? I told you that I found one, actually found two myself, but some of these other ones were found before I was even involved. And I think that the general consensus of the researchers at that time was that these probably came from medium-sized ungulates. So ungulates would be hooved animals, so like a deer. And that really had to do with the size of these bone tools. They were pretty small and worn down. But once I started studying, and I've looked at a lot of these similar types of bone tools from other contexts, not that were made and used by Neanderthals, but that were made and used by like people like you and me in more recent time periods. And after looking at those, I had an inkling that they were actually larger bovids, some sort of large bovid. But like, I couldn't prove it. That's what I figured at that point. It was just like exciting to see that my, that I predicted it correctly, even though, you know, I didn't say it anywhere in publication or anything, but just in my mind, that's what I thought it was.
What was the most fascinating aspect of this study?
So, for me, it is like truly fascinating that we can test plastic that once touched a bone. And so there is this transfer of collagen from the bone to the plastic. And so we can get these, get this result, get the collagen off of the plastic. So that's just like, when I first even like heard about the idea, considered doing it, it just seemed like fantastical to me. So that was really cool.
What were the challenges the team faced during the research?
Actually, I think I mentioned this in one of the previous questions, but I think the main challenge had to do with validating our results and just proving that our results are what we say they are.
How frequently did the Neanderthals use bones to manufacture tools?
So in general, when Neanderthals were living in Europe and in the Near East, they didn't use very many bone tools, or at least they don't preserve well, or if they were using bone tools, the evidence of it is pretty hard to come by. So it's kind of hard to say if they were using bone tools. So the most common type of bone tools that they used were these bone fragments that they then used to like sharpen the edge of a stone tool. We call those retouchers. So I would say they used those like fairly frequently because they were using stone tools a lot. We find lots and lots of stone tools in the archaeological record. And so they need to sharpen their stone tools somehow. So often they did use bone to sharpen them. So that type of bone tool would be considered like an opportunistic bone tool. You just pick up a piece of bone and use it. The type of bone tool that it was in this study, I don't even think I've said the name yet, Niçoise, which means smoother. Those were extremely uncommon. And so far they've only been found at a handful of sites. And I guess there are some other bone tools that Neanderthals used in later time periods. So the latest Neanderthals before they go extinct. But I would say for the most part, they don't seem to be using, or they didn't seem to be using bone tools very frequently.
You mentioned the bone tools were obtained from two different sites. Geographically, how far were these sites located from each other?
They're about 35 kilometers away in this nice little quaint region of the southwest of France on different tributaries of a river in the southwest France.
What do we know about the history of these sites and the bone tools?
So both these sites were actually excavated several times. The Pestalozzi site is actually a complex of sites. So this one is Pestalozzi 1, and I believe they have 2, 3, 4, and 5. I'm not sure if they all have archaeology found at them. Yep, I'd have to go back and look at the literature about that. But I know the Pestalozzi complex of sites was excavated over 100 years ago. And I know back in 1909, there was the remains of a Neanderthal child found. So that's probably what that site is most famous for. And then the other site, Abri-Pyrénées, is again a site in a complex of sites. The complex there is called the Combe-Capelle sites. I think it was originally published back in 1925. The first excavations would have happened a few years before that. And then it was re-excavated in the 90s, and then again in 2010, maybe 2009 through 11, something like that. And that was the most recent excavation there.
How old are the tools that you and your team studied?
So these bone tools are about the same age at both sites, about 50,000 years old.
How did you obtain those specimens?
How did we obtain them? So they were found either during excavation on site, or they were found after excavation when all the artifacts were being cleaned. And then we basically, once we excavate a site, we collect them all, we tag them all, and then they go with the rest of the collection. Because they were potential bone tools, they were kept aside, and then I just needed permission from the two PIs on these two different sites. And so the two PIs were, I mentioned them earlier, Shannon McFerrin. So when I say PI, principal investigator, Shannon McFerrin is the PI on Abri-Pyrénées, and Marie Sorcy is the PI for Pestalozzi 1. So.
You mentioned the result from one of the sites did not give any positive results. What could be the reason for that?
So most of the time, it has to do with just collagen preservation. So that particular bone likely did not have enough collagen left in it to then test. I guess I can't say that with 100% confidence, because we didn't destructively sample that one. Maybe we would have had result if we actually destructively sampled it. We just did the non-destructive method and we couldn't get results. So chances are it did have less collagen than the other ones.
What do we know about lozhuas, and do we know how Neanderthals manufactured lozhuas?
Yeah, so l'histoire is the... We can say that's the typological type of tool. So it's like a category of tool that Neanderthals made and used. This particular category of tool was actually found in archaeological sites that are a little younger than these Neanderthal sites. And so it was known for a very long time in some of these other sites made by Homo sapiens, right? So not Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, people like me and you. So in general, what we know about lissoirs is that they're these elongated piece of bones, often made on ribs, but not always. Sometimes they're made on like the long bone of an animal, like a leg bone of an animal. But most often they're made on ribs. They have this rounded distal working end that often exhibits polish. And so these Neanderthal made ones found at this Neanderthal site really like fits really well into this category that these other ones used by Homo sapiens in subsequent time periods. And we know that they were manufactured because if you use a microscope to look at the surface of these bone tools, you will see striations, parallel striations, at the tip of the tools and along the edges of the tools that are consistent with scraping and grinding against like a stone tool. So a stone tool would have been used to shape the end of it.
How did you confirm the lissoirs was used for working animal skin to leather?
So there was a study back in 2013 that I was actually a co-author on, but I hadn't done any of the analyses on the bone tools yet at that point. There were other people doing the analyses on the bone tools at that point. And so one of the co-authors on that paper back in 2013 that was published in PNAS did what they call a useware or microware analysis on the Pestalozzi one piece. And so she used a high-powered microscope and compared the micro topography of the bone tool to a micro topography of like an experimental tool that was used on leather. And they looked very, very similar. So in general, the changes that happened to the surface of the bone looked very, very consistent with use on something soft and supple like leather. And then since 2013, for my dissertation, I have done a very similar study myself and would say for the most part, the other tools look pretty similar. Yeah, that stuff isn't published yet, but hopefully it will be published soon.
Do we know how Neanderthals used the leather?
No. And that would be really, really difficult to get at. I imagine it was used as clothing and probably like even footwear, maybe turned into shoes of some sort. This clothing and footwear would be pretty simple. We know they didn't have anything like sophisticated, like needles for sewing anything tailored, but probably some sort of clothing, I would say. But I mean, but the leather probably was used for other things as well. Like, you know, you could make a bag out of it, or you could use it as shelter over like a cave opening or something, a blanket. You know, when they were sleeping, there's probably all sorts of different uses.
Which technologies were used for the study?
Can you elaborate on that question more? What do you mean? Which technologies?
The ones which you used for getting all the results, other than zooms.
Other than zooms?
Yeah, since you mentioned zooms, other than that, were any other technologies used?
Technologies. So you mean specifically to study the artifacts, technologies yes. on the artifacts?
Yes.
For this study, I would say no, it was just the zooms that was done on the artifacts.
Could you briefly explain how zooms technology works?
Sure. So zooms analyzes the collagen from ancient bones. Collagen is an organic protein that degrades over time. So depending how well this collagen is preserved in this archaeological bone, you may or may not have enough collagen to study. But then if you do have enough collagen, so zooms can basically be used as like a chemical fingerprint to identify a species that the bone came from. So the collagen gets broken down into peptide components, and depending on which peptides are there, you can sort of think of it like DNA. When you have certain like genes there, like the presence of a gene means something. In zooms, the presence of a particular protein or the combination of a couple different proteins means it belongs to a certain animal. So if you just have one protein present, you know, it might be kind of difficult to say what animal it came from, but the more you have, then you can be more confident in what animal or type of animal it's coming from.
What were the advantages of using bones from bovine animals over reindeers?
So, I think it mostly has to do with the size. So these large bovids are definitely larger than reindeer. Reindeer actually have pretty thin and flimsy ribs, and large bovids like cattle or bison, they have really, really robust ribs. And so they're thicker, they're stronger, and they're going to be more resistant to breaking during flexion. And probably the action of using this tool would cause it to bend under pressure. And so when you have this thicker rib, then there's less chance that it's going to break during use.
Apart from the strength, how do the rib bones or bones differ from those of reindeers?
So I guess they'd be a little longer as well. I mean, it's a bigger animal, so they're going to be longer. The morphology is probably going to be slightly different. I would say in general, ungulates, I mentioned that term before, hoofed animals, they have pretty similar rib morphologies, like flatter ribs. But so like if you just had a piece of like the rib like on the side of the animal, then you might not be able to tell what it came from. But if you have a piece preserved like the head of the rib or near the vertebral articulation of the rib, there will be some slight morphological differences where you'd be able to tell what animal it came from.
Did the Neanderthals use reindeer bones for some other purposes?
I don't think, as far as we know, they weren't used for specific purposes. I mentioned the retouchers before, like bones just used to like sharpen a lithic edge. I'm sure there were lots and lots of reindeer, not ribs, but reindeer leg bones used to resharpen stone tools. But those probably weren't selected for a specific purpose. That was just because it was there to use.
Does this imply Neanderthals were inclined using bones from one species over the other?
So, I think there would need to be more research to say something like that. But in my opinion, I don't think so. I think it has more to do with the size of the animal. In their environment at that time, these large bovids were the larger animals on the landscape. So I think that's why they used those ribs as opposed to the reindeer or something else that was more abundant. Yeah.
How did you make sure this available data is not survivor's bias?
Can you repeat that again?
How did you make sure this available data is not survivor's bias?
Survivor's bias. Can you tell me which question that was? Which number you had it as?
I didn't happen to have added that. I updated the list today.
It was a new one. Catching me off guard. Yeah, okay. So I suppose it could be. So you mean like an issue of preservation, like the only ones that were preserved, happened to be preserved, were the larger bovid bones. I suppose that could be an issue, but we did look at all of the fauna from the site and specifically looked at all the ribs from the site as well. And there are plenty of rib fragments from reindeer or from smaller species. And they do not seem to be preserved any less frequently, I guess, than the large bovid ribs. So I don't think that is an issue at the site.
Zooms usually involve drilling the artifacts. How did your team come to the idea that you would rather use the collagen stuck to the walls of the containers?
So the inspiration for the analysis was really from another team that did it first. So I was at a conference in 2017, and I saw that another team had done this. And so, I talked to my colleagues and we decided that we needed to try this on our bone tools too.
For how long were these bone tools exposed to the plastic containers?
So it was a various amounts of time depending on a number of things, how long the artifacts had been found, what they had been curated in before, because not all of them were curated in something plastic beforehand. But most of the Abreperini ones were sitting in a plastic box for about 5 years. One of them had been found more recently, and it was only in its plastic box for about 2 months. And then we tested the Pesh one after it had been in a plastic bag for about 5 months.
Has this type of non-destructive zooms been used for studying bones and artifacts dating back millennia?
So not back millennia. I mentioned this other team who did it first, and they did it non-destructively on Iroquoian bone tools. So that would be a couple hundred years old. But so far, this particular type of non-destructive zooms hadn't been done on anything older.
How did the team make sure the samples gathered from the walls of these containers were not contaminated?
So, as I mentioned before, validating our results and ruling out contamination, it was a big issue for us. And so we took lots and lots of different measures to do this. And in the paper, we mentioned 7 different ways how we did this. So just starting from when you run the Zoom samples, you just always leave a sample blank. So one where you don't have any collagen in it. So then if you get results at the end and there is some sort of collagen, then you know your samples are all contaminated, but that one was blank, so that was good. We also tested the empty boxes, so similar boxes that never held any archaeological specimens before. Those came back empty of any collagen as well. Next, we tested the washing water that artifacts... So when we excavate, they're covered in dirt most of the time, so we always wash them to get this dirt off, and especially for the teeny tiny bone fragments, those get washed together because they're all in a bag together, like really teeny tiny, like less than 2 centimeters big, small pieces, so those get washed together like in a little water bath. And so then we tested that water to see if any collagen was contaminating the water, or if there could be any chance of cross-contamination during this washing process. So then the third way was to, when we were doing the identifications, all the IDs came back as one animal. If it was contaminated, you would have like IDs that didn't make sense, you know, like proteins popping up from, you know, not just these large bovids, but also reindeer, or something else in there. Then the next way was to look to see if there were any peptides from hemoglobin or from keratin. And there wasn't anything like that, so we ruled out any contamination from like the skins that may have been worked by these tools. And then there's two more ways that we did. Since we didn't want to destroy these objects, we couldn't confirm our results destructively, so we got a sample from just the other fauna at the site, and so most of those we had good morphological identifications on, and so I mean identifications based on morphology. We can say, yes, this piece is a reindeer. We know that 100% certainty. And so then when we did we also did destructive zooms as well as non-destructive zooms. And when we did get positive, so that didn't always work. Sometimes we didn't get results at all, but when we did get positive results, for the most part, it was all confirming each other. And then the last way that we ruled out contamination was we looked at the deamidation calculations of the collagen, and it showed that the collagen was degraded and therefore ancient. So then we were able to rule out modern contaminants in there as well.
Do we know which animals did Neanderthals used for making leather?
No, not at all. We don't know that at all.
How did you account for the contamination that could have occurred while doing these experiments from just merely picking up the bones as compared to from the other sites?
Wait, can you repeat that again? I don't think I fully understood that.
Let me rephrase that.
Is it possible the bones were from different locations gave different results because of the contamination? As you mentioned, one of the sites didn't give any positive results. Could it be possible because it was contaminated?
No, if it was contaminated, then we would have some other result. We didn't have any results. So, I mean, that wouldn't be related to contamination.
Under what conditions was this hypothesis tested on?
And so I don't quite understand that question either. Can you rephrase that in a different way?
Let's see. How did you make sure that everything was pointing back to the same result, provided the number of specimens were not that much?
Yeah, so sample size is always going to be an issue in archaeology. It is. So anybody who's reading the paper is going to have to take the results, I guess, with a grain of salt, because as soon as you start adding more and more samples, maybe results will start to change. But just based on the samples that we have, they were all one thing. And I mean, I think that's fairly good results for a small sample size.
In your blog post about this research, you had mentioned Neanderthals did not necessarily manufacture bones into specific objects. What could be the reason? And can you please explain that?
Yeah, so I think when I said that in the blog post, I was thinking about those retouchers that I mentioned earlier. So these are just the bones that you'd pick up and use to sharpen a stone tool. So those bones don't need to be shaped into any particular object. Those bones are just used the way they are to do a very particular task. And then for the most part, Neanderthals, they didn't really make many other bone tools. That's what we find in the archaeological record. For most of the time Neanderthals were alive, hardly any bone tools were being found, from their archaeological sites. And, I mean, the reason for that, I mean, lots of people have different reasons for this. Some people say, oh, it's because Neanderthals couldn't make bone tools. But now we know with these lissoirs that they did shape them into something to use them. Also, at very, very few sites, some of the latest Neanderthals that ever lived did make some other bone tools. So they definitely were able to make bone tools, but why they didn't make them all the time, that's something harder to get at. Maybe they just didn't need them for their specific purposes.
What does this tell us about their behavior?
What does... what specifically?
The process that Neanderthals followed for making tools from bones, what does that tell us about their behavior?
So do you specifically mean these ones, the lissoirs from this study? Okay. It tells me that they knew what they were doing. They had a clear idea about what type of bone in a certain type of animal would work for a certain purpose. So they obviously had a lot of forethought, they really understood the raw material properties of the particular tools that they were using.
In your career, you had previously worked on a study which stated Neanderthals used sophisticated tools made of bones before humans ever did. Could you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so I believe you're referring to the 2013 study from PNAS. And these are the same bone tools. It's just that paper described the discovery of these tools. And then this current paper is describing one particular aspect, the raw material selection of these tools. And so I guess I just want to comment on that question a little bit. It's not that they made these tools, well, they made them before humans were making them in Europe. I mean, that's the main thing, because Neanderthals were in Europe before humans migrated into Europe. So that was the main thing about that.
So you used the same artifacts for that research as well?
Yes, the same artifacts. And then there was, I found an additional one during my dissertation studies.
So what are the inferences of this study?
I think I've probably said it a couple times now. Just that Neanderthals were definitely selective in their raw material for making these bone tools. And this selection really shows that they had knowledge of the raw material properties of these ribs and knew what they wanted for their particular tasks.
Are we aware of some other bone tools used for some other purposes by Neanderthals?
Well, I mentioned the retouchers before. So those are very, very common at Neanderthal sites. They're not shaped pieces of bone. They're just bone fragments. And then you can see by little impact marks on these bones that they were used to sharpen a lithic tool. And then a few sites in Southwest France the technology, I guess we can say, is Châtelperronian. So it would be like the very latest Neanderthals that lived in Europe. They were making other bone tools then, right before they went extinct. So they made awls, so like elongated pointed objects, likely for piercing, possibly animal skin. They also made some pendants made out of animal teeth, you know, possibly worn as jewelry or something like that. But that was very, very rare, only found at a very small number of sites. And even that is controversial. Not everyone actually believes that Neanderthals made those. There's been debate about that.
Are there any downsides of using a non-destructive zooms procedure?
So I would say the main downside would be that your results might be ambiguous, or maybe you don't even get results at all. Your results are definitely going to be better using the destructive methods.
What does the success of this study mean for the future of archaeology, especially for using non-destructive zooms procedure?
Oh, well, I think a lot of researchers are probably going to be pretty excited about this. Because now there's the possibility to test all sorts of like precious artifacts that nobody ever wanted to sample before. And so now we can at least try to sample these artifacts and see if we get some results for that.
Are there any future plans to explore more about the preferences of Neanderthals from other sites or maybe some other peculiar habits they had?
So if you're speaking of bone tools specifically, I would say I don't have any specific plans at this moment, but I would love to keep doing that if there are more bone tools to study in this way. I would love to do a study on like the retouchers that I mentioned several times now to see if there was some sort of preference with those. But there are plenty of other researchers out there working on raw material selection in Neanderthals, but on stone, right? So for the most part, what we find in the archaeological record, especially in Neanderthal times, is a bunch of stone tools. And so there's actually been lots and lots of research on what Neanderthals were using for their stone tools.
What lies ahead in this field of study?
So I think there needs to be a lot more experimental work done. If you look at all of our results, including the fauna from the two sites, a lot of the pieces didn't have any positive results at all. We had a lot of empty, I guess, spectra. So trying to figure out how this actually works, I guess that's a big thing. In what circumstances, and like using which plastics, right? Because there are like different types of plastics, and maybe certain plastics pull the collagen out of the bone better and stick to the plastic better. So there's all sorts of different experimental things that can be done. Just working on the plastic, various lengths of time, touching the plastic. If it's like rubbing on plastic in a particular way. So there's various things that can be done with that.
What are the other researches you are already working on?
What other research am I currently working on? So I guess the main thing that I'm working on right now, I actually just started as a postdoctoral researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany, although I'm in California right now. I will get over to Leipzig as soon as the world starts opening up again. But my main reason for being hired by them to work in Leipzig is to study the bone artifacts from a site called Bachukiro in Bulgaria. And I was actually in Bulgaria for 5 months, starting in October, studying these the bone artifacts there, as well as animal teeth pendants. But then I'm back in California because that I was in Bulgaria on a Fulbright fellowship that ended, but then I'm gonna try to get back to Europe to continue that study. So that's the main thing I've been working on, I would say, in addition to this.
What was your role at the UC Davis?
So for the past, well, starting in 2012, I guess it was, 2012 to 2019, I was a graduate student. I obtained my PhD last year And then I'm still an associate researcher for UC Davis. So, you know, I still have all my connections there. And I will retain the status of associate researcher for the next couple years.
Anything you would like to add?
Sorry, I think you cut out for a second. I didn't hear what you said.
You said that were all the questions I had for you. Is there anything you would like to add?
Oh, is there anything else? You know, as I was talking, I was like thinking, like, oh, I should have said this and that and the other thing. But like now when you ask me that, I can't remember. I don't know. I think the main thing I just wanted to get across, and maybe I said it a couple times during this talk. Just thinking about Neanderthals, when Neanderthals were living mostly in Europe, also in the Near East, for a couple hundred thousand years during this whole time period, they hardly used bone tools. Or if they did, it was very opportunistically, right? They only made a handful of shaped bone tools for specific purposes. And, when they did do that, they were able to do it like in a very professional way. They knew what they were doing. It wasn't just like, oh, let's just try this thing and see what happens, right? So I guess the main thing I would like to impart maybe to the general public is, you know, I mean, often so much in like a popular media or whatever, Neanderthals kind of get a bad rap as these like, I don't know, subhuman type of ancient people, but they were very, very sophisticated in many, many ways. And with these bone tools, that's just one of the ways.
Thank you for agreeing for this discussion. It had been a great pleasure discussing this with you.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it as well.
Okay. Goodbye.
Okay. But before we get off the call, will I be able, like, will you share the write-up with me or anything?
Yeah, sure thing. I'll be sending you a mail across once the article is ready.
Okay. And then, okay. That sounds good.
If there comes anything that you would like to add, we'll just discuss that via email correspondence.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Have a good night.
Okay, you too. Or have a good day. Goodbye.